On this week's show, PayPal and Bitcoin, Square's planned register that accepts Bitcoin and Apple Pay.
Tony Sakich reviews the Trezor Bitcoin hardware wallet.
And then later, we will sit down and chat with Let's Talk Bitcoin podcast host Stephanie Murphy.
This is Gentry Sherrill.
I'm Tony Sakich.
And I'm Eric Martindale.
And this is Decentralize. Hey, how's it going, everyone? Today on Decentralized, we're going to give a little breakdown of what has been going on in the week of decentralization. And the first thing is PayPal and Bitcoin. It seems like PayPal is getting heavily involved in the Bitcoin space, and just wanted to discuss that a little bit as they process tons of payments. And what do you think about that, Gentry?
I think it's exciting. I mean, I think it's another sign of the continuing maturity and sort of quote-unquote mainstream acceptance of Bitcoin. You know, it's a big step. You know, we've gone past where we hear about a new retailer signing up, and we're actually now hearing about well-known e-commerce and payment platforms integrating.
Absolutely. And I think that it's something where PayPal's involvement with Bitcoin will continue to grow as, you know, they're dipping their toes in, and as they get wetter and wetter, they're going to see, you know, how great it is and how much it's actually going to help them as a business and what exactly they can do to take advantage of it. And, you know, I know it's something where PayPal does a lot with many different websites, not just eBay. You know, they do processing for all kinds of digital goods and physical goods. So it's giving Bitcoin capability to tons of businesses that wouldn't have it otherwise. And I think that is always a benefit.
Yeah, I think for PayPal, this is a no-brainer. PayPal originally, as I understand it, really their vision was to create a truly decentralized payments network. But just the technology wasn't available to them. They weren't capable of pulling it together. Obviously, they had a great team, but they ended up in a centralized solution and, in fact, did disrupt the entire market. But they did end up being centralized, and we can see a lot of sort of pushback against PayPal and their support architecture. And there's a lot of disagreement with how they do things, but if they want to sort of start carving out what they originally were going towards, Bitcoin is a no-brainer for them. So I think it makes a lot of sense why they're moving into the space.
Absolutely. And I think that partnered with the Apple Pay announcement has made for an interesting week or two here in money in general. And I think that, you know, the other interesting thing that happened this week is Square announced their register that will use Apple Pay and accept Bitcoin. And I think that is, to me, much bigger of an announcement than just the Apple Pay announcement, because it does encompass multiple forms of payment, and they really seem to be covering their bases there. And, you know, that's going to be smart, because in 5 or 10 years, it's really going to be about who can buy things at your establishment. And, you know, some people may consider using traditional payment systems. Well, we don't know in 5 or 10 years what will be around, but let's assume it's similar to now. And some will want to use Bitcoin or cryptocurrency. And, you know, we want to make sure that merchants have the choice to accept whatever they want.
Well, and first of all, Square using Apple Pay is an enormous win for Apple Pay, number one. That's big. You know, the acceptance of all these new forms of payment is really dependent, just like with Bitcoin, on almost the network effects and, you know, the degree to which it's adopted. Now, the Bitcoin acceptance for Square is also interesting. And, you know, I think that you see Square getting in the game, you see PayPal. I have to believe that almost every large tech company in the Valley is working on it. You know, Google's got, I'm sure, a team of guys working on Bitcoin-related stuff, even if they aren't saying anything about it. You know, I'm sure that, you know, pretty much every large company you can think of has a team in a lab, you know, cranking out how they're going to be able to integrate Bitcoin, or even how they're going to be able to build on top of Bitcoin and, you know, bend it to their purposes, so to speak.
Yeah, so I think this is a sign of the times. So in any new space, any new industry where there's a lot of innovation taking place, you see a lot of fresh comers to the market. But then at a certain point, you start to see consolidation, which sort of allows the masses to start adopting these technologies. And the consolidators take the top 3-4 technologies or solutions, bundle them up, and then make them easily available. And I think Square is most excellently positioned to do this. And I'm really glad that they're trying to bring this to the markets. They're validating Bitcoin. They're validating Apple Pay. And they have this massive swath of merchants already. It shows that Bitcoin and the payment processing, payment space really, is starting to consolidate, and that just shows the maturity of the market, in my opinion.
Absolutely, and I do think with that coming in, is you're going to see the next big upspurt is going to be something that we'll talk about in a few minutes, which is going to be hardware for this. I think that you're going to see, as more and more people get into Bitcoin, you know, the idea of cold storage is going to be more interesting, but it's going to be something where novices will be scared away, but they're going to want to keep their Bitcoin holdings somewhere very secure. And you're going to see a lot of new ideas come out of how to store it and how to best store it. It could be really interesting there. And it makes me wonder if, you know, is that going to be Apple's place in this? Is that going to be Google's place in this? Is this going to be a place where existing hardware manufacturers can create a product to use with Bitcoin, besides just, you know, accepting it and, you know, something that can work as a point of sale device? And with that coming about, what exactly would be, you know, the next big thing when it comes to that sort of technology and decentralization and hardware? Really does open up a lot of new doors of what can really happen. And, you know, it's been a very exciting week for Bitcoin, and it's been a pretty exciting week for technology in general. And I think that the blah that was felt after the Apple announcement has really changed into something else. And it's changed into, you know, what else is happening in technology? You know, Apple doesn't rule this space. They do have the biggest market share, but it's not just all about them. And much like, you know, everything else that leads, eventually they become number two. And then, and you know, you never know what's going to come and take over number one's positioning when it comes to hardware. And it's really interesting in that field. And I think that's something interesting that we talked with Stephanie about, too, as far as decentralization. And back to that point is podcasting and, you know, how this is it's not really decentralized as a network, but it is decentralized in that the gatekeepers are being removed. And I think that's the definition I would like this podcast to go after, which is no gatekeepers. You know, podcasts do have gatekeepers if you want it on iTunes, but they don't have gatekeepers if you just want to post it. You're getting your message out there, and it's getting out there in a pure form that you want it to be heard. And it's giving people the power again. And, you know, that's very cool that these large companies are being a part of people getting power again.
Yeah, absolutely. You say that Apple has the biggest market share in what space?
Hardware.
Hardware?
Well, not necessarily hardware. Let me rephrase that. Consumer goods. You know, I mean, if they have the largest, I would say they're the largest manufacturer of smartphones. There's no smartphone model that sells more than the iPhone. You know, is there?
I think they've dropped some from something like 70-80% to 20%,
yes,
in terms of market share, in terms of devices in people's hands at this point.
Yes, but I still think as far as one model goes, there is no model that outsells the iPhone. I don't quote me on that. These are anecdotal statistics and not data-driven statistics.
Isn't that a bit of an oxymoron, an anecdotal statistic?
Yep, just made it. I like the English language because you could just invent words if you don't know what you're talking about, and that's what I just did. So, yeah, it doesn't really make sense. And as you can tell, there is excitement. Maybe you can't tell. There's distracted excitement as the Bitcoin price is rising. So we're all watching it here. It's very interesting. So you get a little live feedback here with that. So the thing I wanted to discuss earlier was I purchased a Trezor, and I love it. It was fantastic. It's very easy to use. The security settings were extremely simple. The only qualm I have about it is the size of it. It just feels like something I could lose, and
how large is it?
It's the size of about a USB drive, so it's not very large. And you know, the security settings are great. Everything seems really easy to use, intuitive.
So they have suggestions. You know, I go get a Trezor. Where do I keep it? Do I put it in a safety deposit box? Do I put it in a safe? Do I just, you know, stick it under my couch? Like,
yeah, that's what I'm feeling, too. I'm thinking safety deposit box because you'd still make deposits to your wallet without having it physically in your presence. But I don't necessarily know if that's what I want to do with it. Do I want to just buy a fireproof safe? Do I want to – there's many different ways from there that you could take it, and you take it to that next level of real-world security. That's exactly the problem that I'm facing, is it's so small that I could totally see myself stepping on it. And that's not good, you know. And I think the first ones were metal, and then they ended up coming out with plastic versions. I kind of wish they would have kept the metal, even if it was a little more money, just for, you know, that feeling of sturdiness. And that's really the only negative thing I can say.
plastic things tend to feel cheap, obviously.
Yeah, and it doesn't feel cheap at all. It actually feels really cool, and it's very tiny and easy to use. There's nothing, you know, unpleasant about the experience. But, you know, I like that feeling. Actually, I love the feeling of a MacBook Air because it feels metal. It feels sturdy. And there's a lot to that, that is more psychological than actually product-driven. But
I mean, let's put this in perspective, right? Like, this is a few guys who got together and are basically building their own hardware project. They crowdfunded it. They want to have a solution for hardware wallets. There is no way that these guys are going to be able to put together such a package product like the iPhone or any of these consumer-grade electronics. Like, these guys are disrupting the space massively simply by the very nature of getting to this to a product in people's hands by themselves.
Oh, I completely agree. And when I was saying what I was saying, it merely is the only gripe I have. And that is a minor gripe that's completely understandable. You know, it's nothing that I'm majorly complaining about. I wouldn't – if that's something that's going to hold anyone back from buying a Trezor, then I would question that because it's definitely not something that would hold me back from buying another one.
This is V1. You know, they're going to have V2.
It is. Yeah, and it makes me wonder, when I was saying earlier, who's going to be the next to get into this space? Because, you know, people are going to want their Bitcoin protected as much as possible. And what's next? You know, this seems very cool and very interesting, the way the security is set up. And it really does leave a new – it kind of starts a new industry, really. And, you know, what will become of that and what will evolve out of that? You may have noticed we had a little break there. What's happening right now is in the past hour since the last PayPal announcement, Bitcoin has went up about $50. So needless to say, everyone is staring at their computers intently and interestingly watching this rise. We decided to just keep it live here and actually discuss what's happening so people can kind of hear what's really happening while we're recording this and the price is going up. Obviously, it's Bitcoin. You know, that's what Bitcoin does. So Bitcoin be Bitcoinin'. But either way, it's very interesting that this is happening live right now. Eric, what are you thinking about this?
Hodler's going to hodl. yeah, this is awesome. We've seen a lot of price consolidation over the past 7 months, I would say. Since November, we had the big price bubble up to almost $1,300 on most of the public exchanges. And we've seen a lot of depression in the markets as everyone sort of retracts back and the price corrects. I think that this may be a bounce off of the lower boundary, and we're going to start seeing some further upward movement. No, I won't say that this is going to be a big bubble, but I definitely think the price is going to swing back.
So I'm going to be the bear here, and I'm going to say that, you know, I think this is, you know, an hour's reaction to an admittedly interesting and positive statement, but, you know, we need to wait and really see if this is a consistent movement. And really, in my opinion, it doesn't matter that much. You know, I think that Bitcoin is going in the right direction. And it's funny because I know both of you guys were looking at the chart. I was actually answering a totally unrelated email. I wasn't even looking at the chart.
I'm usually not someone who stares at the charts either. I kind of view it more as a long-term investment. But, you know, when everyone's distracted by it, it becomes something where, you know, it's interesting to talk about because whenever you hear people, you know, talk about the negatives of Bitcoin, it's always, oh, it's volatile. I think that's what makes it more fun, honestly. And I think that the volatility is going to eventually go down. It's just a matter of when and, you know, at what volume and what price it becomes less, you know, unstable. Either way, though, it's very interesting and fun to see it, this as it's unfolding. And, you know, what exactly is happening and what will be happening in the next few months, what we're hoping will happen. And, you know, the old adage is to the moon. And I don't know if we're going to get to the moon right away, but I think we're going to get to low Earth orbit pretty soon. And that's going to be pretty awesome. And then we can tackle that moon voyage.
Yeah, I think you're right about watching the charts. It ultimately doesn't matter other than the U.S. dollar to Bitcoin exchange rate represents the market's valuation.
Sort of a bellwether. You know, it's psychological. I totally get, you know, why you do it. And I mean, I'm not saying that I don't do it either. I'm just saying that, you know, I think the best thing to do is to detach yourself from the emotion of that and then rationally evaluate it.
Yeah, totally. If you treat it like a speculative investment,
right.
Then
exactly.
Of course. But if you want to get to the future, the truly decentralized future that I think that we're all hoping for, then you recognize that the U.S. dollar to Bitcoin price should be decoupled and ultimately won't matter. What will matter will be what is the purchasing power of 100 bits, yep. right? Rather than the price of one Bitcoin in some other fiat state script.
Absolutely. And I think this is a good spot for probably us for us to end this and continue to watch this rise off air. So we just wanted to give you a little bit of insight of what's happening right now in the room. And we hope to do this in the future, things like this that are a little off the cuff and not necessarily perfect for podcasting, but interesting nonetheless, because it's a very unique field. So I'm going to let it go for now.
We're actually seeing a little bit of consolidation back to the 415 mark at this point, which is interesting to me.
Oh, see?
See, I made my comments, and it's gone down $30.
Jeez, Gentry, it's a good thing we're not broadcasting this live.
Yeah.
We've just been joined by Jason Dreisner, a notorious college dropout and a member of the Austrian School of Economics. Jason, tell us a little bit about yourself.
Thanks, Eric. I do design at BitPay. I also happen to do a lot of Bitcoin trading. I'm of the Austrian variety in my economic leanings, and I do enjoy watching the Bitcoin price occasionally.
Excellent. So we just had a big price movement from sort of a stable value at around 400 to 395 to about 450 U.S. dollars. Tell us a little bit what you make of that.
I'm actually a little surprised to see any price movement on this news, because there are going to be enough people involved in this news. There are three different companies that were announced, of course, BitPay, Coinbase, and GoCoin, and then enough people working at PayPal that the Bitcoin market is a 24/7 worldwide market. Plenty of people are familiar with this news. So the fact that this price movement actually happened with this news is really surprising to me and says to me that it's not actually based on the news. This looks more like somebody was looking for an excuse to make this happen in the market.
So do you think that might be related to the recent launch of the GAVI ETF?
I actually – maybe, but I would be more – I would actually think that it's more along the lines of some large traders trying to close a bunch of the shorts that were happening on the market. Spying this as an opportunity to pump the price up just enough to hit margin calls, so that anybody is shorting the current Bitcoin price will have to take that loss, and that trader then gets to make that money. So
someone
with lots of money in the market was able to do this, and I doubt it was some sort of organized group.
So in a lot of these price consolidation periods, like we've seen over the past 9 months, we see a lot of infighting, a lot of arguments. People who are against Bitcoin, people who are for Bitcoin, start to call each other out and say, put your money where your mouth is. There's a lot of pressure on the people who, you know, are active anti-Bitcoiners to you know, put your money where your mouth is. And, you know, if you don't believe in Bitcoin, why not make a bunch of money by shorting it? What do you make of that?
Well, that's interesting. A lot of them are probably not going to be interested in buying assets that aren't on some sort of formal exchange, because most of the time they're not going to be super familiar with Bitcoin if they're against it. So they're probably more simply traditionalist in their approach to organizing their portfolio. But I would say to that, I don't really try to sell Bitcoin to many people. I just, you know, mention that I keep most of my own personal assets in the investments that I believe in.
That's excellent, because I know you. I think you joined me in the camp that accepts 100% of their pay in Bitcoin. Is that accurate?
Yep.
Excellent. So, what about you, Gentry?
Oh boy, man, I'm going to be exposed here. I get $80
a week. $80 a week in Bitcoin,
which is not unreasonable. Especially, there are a lot of people at BitPay, or a lot of people that I at BitPay and other companies that I'm familiar with, that don't take their pay directly in Bitcoin, but they'll take their pay in dollars and then choose to trade into Bitcoin, which is not an unreasonable approach to have, so long as you're hodling properly.
So, I mean, you say that, you know, maybe $50 a week is not unreasonable, but. What does that actually mean? What does that mean for the future value of Bitcoin? That means you must be some hell of a bull.
Well, I take my full paycheck in Bitcoin, so yes, definitely.
Yeah, and I mean, and even me, you know, with $80 a week, I look at it as a far better form of like a 401k or something. You know, I basically took the money that, you know, I would have, before I came to BitPay and was even involved in Bitcoin, would have been putting into the stock market. And I said, you know what, I'm going to just put that into Bitcoin. And it's awesome. And it's going to greatly outperform the alternative.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about that idealized future where we stop valuing things in U.S. dollars and we start looking at Bitcoin as a store of value and a currency.
Sure.
And we have a truly decentralized economy. What is the purchasing power of one Bitcoin?
I mean, what's the purchasing power of $1?
Next to nothing.
Right. I mean, yes, because there's only going to be a limited number of Bitcoins. The relative value of a Bitcoin will be higher than that of a dollar. But, I mean, I think that we were basically getting at the fact that whether it's a Bitcoin or a dollar, it's simply a means of a value transference. You know, it doesn't really have any innate value.
Well, you know, if we talk about this future, I'm starting to imagine where if you have value across the entire world's population, you say, well, if people are trying to do trade and you have some sort of, you know, bell curve distribution of wealth or something like that, just sort of through the natural market economics, then there is sort of a purchasing power of one Bitcoin. And it's effectively what is the value of the world's economy divided
Sure.
by what is the money supply or the currency supply, whatever it may be. And I think rather than comparing it to the U.S. dollar, which in my opinion will eventually become worthless and no longer exist, I think people will – the competing currencies will all be cryptocurrencies. And I wonder what the split will be. Will it be, you know, clear majority Bitcoin, or will it be some other forms of cryptocurrency? What do you think, Jason?
I'd actually be surprised to see significant competition in the units that are seen as currency. I can see there being, you know, competition and protocol, but fundamentally currency is, I guess from the Austrian perspective, in the School of Austrian Economics, currency is one of those things that actually does make sense, that will have a natural monopoly in most senses and in a way that isn't actually negative. There's really just no reason for us to have
Right.
competing currencies if, you know, X government isn't constantly stealing from the poor. I would be surprised if in 50 years when the universe uses Bitcoin that we have any significant competition.
Yeah, I would agree. Do you imagine it to be Bitcoin or some extension of the blockchain or the Bitcoin blockchain?
I would actually be surprised at this point if the units that we currently call Bitcoin that are currently on the Bitcoin protocol are ever simply changed to another currency. I expect that the people who already have a stake in Bitcoin will have a stake in whatever comes next because they've simply reached a critical mass of there's enough economic power behind that group that I would be very surprised for that to be usurped.
Yeah, I mean, it's inertia, you know. I think you would have to see a truly next-level technology or use case for another protocol to come in and, you know, displace Bitcoin. You're not going to see Litecoin or Dogecoin or any of the other altcoins because they have a cute mascot, for example, end up replacing Bitcoin.
What does that transition period look like, do you think?
Out of dollars and into Bitcoin?
Yeah.
Surprising, probably, would be a very good
How very
term.
Astute.
I think
transition.
I mean, if we just look at history, it's probably going to take place, the majority of it, rather, is probably going to take place very fast. On the scale of history, it will seem like an afternoon. But over the course of, I would be surprised if it lasts longer than a year, in which the main movement from dollar to Bitcoin as the global reserve currency took place.
So recently we had the former director of the U.S. Mint, Ed Moy, who served underneath both the Bush administrations and the Obama administrations. He came out and said that he believes that the era of fiat is coming to a close and that the upcoming era is one of a cryptocurrency. Do you think that there is a large camp of people within or previously within the government who also subscribe to that school of thought?
I wonder. I would be surprised to see a lot of people who are kind of technocratically involved in the existing financial system having those kinds of viewpoints, because fundamentally, to be involved in that system, you kind of have to have some of the more mainstream viewpoints, the things that are going to be taught by the textbook, and most mainstream thought isn't going to be really questioning these things. These aren't really questions that are talked about much. So I would be surprised if many of them are even familiar with it, actually. But of the people who are going to be familiar with it, especially going to be the higher levels of government. One of the coolest things about Bitcoin is that it is it's simple to take part in pseudonymously. And I expect that as Bitcoin grows, a lot of what we would call the political elite class can take part in the Bitcoin revolution pseudonymously, which I think probably will do more for Bitcoin than a lot of the combative viewpoints, funny enough.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. So you say pseudonymously, which is as it exists today, Bitcoin is pseudonymous. It's not truly anonymous, right? So what do you make of all of these efforts to make cryptocurrency, and in a lot of ways Bitcoin specifically, to make it more anonymous or completely anonymous, such as zero-knowledge proofs, stealth addresses to some extent manage this, coin join, merge avoidance. What do you make of this growing pressure to ensure financial privacy?
I think it's very, very healthy. I don't expect it's really so big of a problem right now in the Bitcoin space. I do appreciate that it's being worked on as quickly as possible, because the sooner the better. That technology should be ready to happen as soon as it needs to. It's not necessarily it certainly isn't easier for us to promote Bitcoin to the masses right now if it's easy to demagogue. So it is kind of nice to be able to say, well, actually, everything in the blockchain is traceable. That helps us a lot when we're working on mass adoption right now. Though, as from a fundamental human respect and privacy and rights standpoint, financial anonymity is a fundamental right. And I believe that that will need to happen. Though I can wait for a year or two, because this is certainly easy. This is very nice right now.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. Don't you think that if these efforts gain a little bit more traction, that we will start to see a lot more resistance from the centralized powers that be? And furthermore, do you think that if that's the case, wouldn't fighting that battle now be a better way of getting this technology out into the forefront and furthermore accepted? Because ultimately, this is going to win. There is no stopping this revolution.
Yeah. I don't know. As far as like a strategy standpoint, getting a lot of the anonymity stuff in as quickly as possible is, of course, probably highest priority, at least in my personal viewpoint. I actually, to what you were saying with kind of centralized authorities being against Bitcoin's growth, I actually am much more along the lines. I'm hoping that the pseudonymous nature of Bitcoin right now will allow those entities to take a very passive view on Bitcoin, take a very passive stance, and not really even involve themselves in the discussion until like the internet, no one is going to do anything with, significantly to inhibit the use of that technology. At least, in a society like the U.S., we don't expect that now that we've had the internet here in the U.S. for a while, that suddenly it's going to be possible politically to turn it off. So I hope that actually those centralized authorities will take a very passive stance. And because you're able to participate in the Bitcoin economy without being super public with your real life identity, that a lot of the people who would be participating in those centralized authorities and would be doing the attacking, would be committing the violence, those people can be passive in their public, in their government roles, so to speak, and either participate or be passive in their personal life.
Okay, so you talk a lot about decentralized, and you make a comparison to the internet. The fact of the matter is, though, that once the government got involved in the internet, they started making more and more movements to allow them the ability to shut it down or to surveil or to violate and trespass on individual rights. Don't you think that part of this overall revolution is effectively rebuilding that infrastructure in such a way that it eliminates the entire possibility of an outside party interjecting themselves into this communications platform over which the currency platform is built?
Yes, I would certainly appreciate that development to happen. I guess I would take the approach of I believe that this is really a lot of it is happening, and I think it's great to motivate developers to be looking into these to anonymity solutions. You know, personally, I'm of course not working on it myself, but I love to see that it's being worked on. So in that from that standpoint, yes, I'm definitely appreciative of that happening.
Cool. So you would obviously support efforts like CJDNS and other meshnet projects.
Yeah. And I'd say because hopefully we've learned some lessons from the internet where these holes shouldn't go unpatched for very long. So I'm not worried about not getting anonymity solutions into Bitcoin in the next 6 months. I'd be very worried if in 5 years it looks exactly as it does right now.
What do you think of Comcast's recent war of aggression against Tor users?
I am probably not familiar enough with it to make much of a comment. I'm not really familiar enough with exactly what's happening. Of course, I tend to find myself siding with the Tor users on any circumstance if it's in some sort of embattlement with an ISP. But I also respect private property rights and the property of the ISPs, hypothetically. So I'd have to look at the specific circumstance.
All right. Jason Dreisner for president. And with that, we'll call this a wrap.
Earlier, Gentry and I sat down and spoke with Stephanie Murphy of Let's Talk Bitcoin. So, Stephanie, how are you doing today?
Awesome.
I think the first thing we'd like to do is introduce you to our audience and find out a little bit about you. What exactly do you do? I know that you do a lot of voiceover work. How did you get into that field? And describe to us a little bit about what that's all about.
Cool. Well, hi, I'm Stephanie Murphy. Thank you for having me on your podcast. This is really great. Well, I think a lot of people who are listening to this show might know me because I am a host of Let's Talk Bitcoin. Let's Talk Bitcoin is a twice weekly podcast about Bitcoin and cryptocurrency, and we interview lots of guests in the cryptocurrency space. And I do that with Adam B. Levine, who's the main host, and Andreas Antonopoulos. We've been going on our partnership for about a year and a half now. And I'm also a voice actor, and I voice a lot of videos for clients in the Bitcoin world, but also beyond that, you know, I make audiobooks. I have several titles on audible.com. I produce commercials. Like, sometimes people tell me that they randomly hear me on Pandora Radio and stuff. It's always cool when that happens. So I make radio commercials, audiobooks, video narrations, and all types of voiceover.
How did that turn into the podcast that you're doing right now, Let's Talk Bitcoin?
Oh, well, it kind of was the other way around. I actually came to working full-time with my voice from a totally different background. I was a scientist, and if you've followed my work, I guess you might see me sometimes referred to as Stephanie Murphy, PhD, or Dr. Stephanie Murphy. And it's true, I've got a PhD in biochemistry. And I also went to medical school for 2 years, but ultimately I decided to make a career change, and I did not finish medical school, but I did, you know, get that PhD in biochemistry and was a scientist for a while. And basically, you know, it was kind of an unfree type of career. You know, it was frustrating in many ways when experiments didn't work, and it was just, you know, kind of working within this kind of conformist system, I guess you could say. And I really wanted to make a change, and I had been podcasting as a hobby. I had started like an advice podcast, you know, like kind of like Dan Savage, like a relationship advice podcast with one of my friends that we'd been doing for a couple of years while I was working in science. And it kind of grew, and a lot of people were listening to my show and telling me, you know, you have a really nice voice. I love to listen to your podcast because your voice is just so cool. And I thought, oh, that's interesting. At the time, I wasn't thinking of making a career change. But then later, I started feeling like, well, maybe I do want to do something different. I'm not really exactly super happy working in science and medicine. So maybe I should look into different kinds of careers. And what could I do where I could work from home, work for myself, or potentially work from anywhere in the world, you know, be location independent? What could I do that's basically making money for myself on the internet and going at my own pace on my own terms? And I came up with voiceover as a great career for that. It really allows you a lot of freedom. So I started doing a bunch of research on it, and I did some basically like volunteer work. So I made an audiobook out of a book that was sort of like a Creative Commons type book. I did some commercials for playing on other people's podcasts or on my own podcast. I started learning how to use Audacity, the digital audio workstation, which is a really cool open source audio workstation. And I got familiar with all that, and I upgraded my microphone quality and so forth. And eventually, when I was ready to make that career change, I was able to transition to working full-time in voiceover. I had built up my portfolio and gotten some clients, and I knew how to get more clients, and it was a really smooth transition. So right now, what do I do in voiceover? Well, I make audiobooks, video narrations, radio and TV commercials. Basically, I do kind of everything. Phone systems too. You know, sometimes when you call a company, it's like, hello, thank you for calling Decentralized Podcast or whatever. I do that. So I've learned how to do all kinds of voiceover work. I use a lot of online casting sites, and also people know me from the podcasts that I do, from Let's Talk Bitcoin and from some of the other radio shows that I've been on, Free Talk Live. And I had Pork Therapy was my first podcast, the relationship advice show. So people know me from those, but they also stumble upon me through my website, which is smvoice.info that I've set up. So how did Let's Talk Bitcoin start? Oh boy. I have to answer this big question. So basically, right after I went full-time on my voiceover stuff and I left working in science, I got contacted by Adam B. Levine. And he was a listener of my podcast, Pork Therapy, which was the main podcast that I was doing at that time. And he said, hey, Stephanie, I know you're into Bitcoin because you've talked about it on the show, and I know you do voiceover work, so would you be willing to record an intro for this podcast that I'm starting? The podcast is called The Daily Bitcoin Show. And I said, sure, yeah, I'll do that. So I made them a podcast intro and outro, and, you know, he paid me in Bitcoin. And what he was going to do was do a daily podcast about Bitcoin 5 days a week, which was really an ambitious thing. I mean, like, you just can't keep up with that, and especially if you're doing any amount of editing, because podcast editing just takes a while. And he had this co-host who was in Israel and really nice guy, Ellie, but, you know, the latency was a killer. You know, they were trying to record on Skype, and as you know, if someone's far away, it really doesn't sound very good in terms of audio quality, because people, you know, there's this long latency and people are talking over each other and what? Pause. What? You know? So that wasn't going to work out. So Adam decided to change the format to Let's Talk Bitcoin and have it just be twice a week instead of five times a week. And he said, hey, you're a radio host. You like Bitcoin. You know, we already know we've worked with you. We like you. Why don't you be a co-host on the show? And so I said, sure. And then we brought on Andreas, and the rest is history, basically, with Let's Talk Bitcoin.
Fantastic. While we're talking about podcasts, I found it interesting. The first time I actually heard of the podcast was on the After Dark show with Brian Alvarez, and I heard you on that. And that actually is funny, because Brian Alvarez has been doing podcasting or similar things to podcasting since about 1998 with this site that was called IATA. And it was a very weird internet radio site that got swallowed up in the dot-com boom. And it was very interesting, because his show was the only one that basically kept it afloat for 2 years. And, you know, they had millions of dollars of investing, and it just really didn't work out, and it ended. But it was really a few years ahead of its time. So I thought it was interesting that there's definitely this little network of podcasts
that are coming out that are giving, you know, everyday people a chance to speak on a topic, and things like yours, which I think is the best Bitcoin podcast out there. And it, you know, it gives you a unique platform that you can speak on for as long as you want. And it's really very little control, very few gatekeepers. So it's fantastic. And it's great to hear that you're doing such good work with that. The other thing I would like to follow up with that is that how you heard of Bitcoin, or were you involved in it slightly before that?
Oh, no. And that's a cool history thing about Brian Alvarez. I didn't know he was basically podcasting since 1998. That's really cool. I guess the world wasn't quite ready for it yet, but obviously they were after that. No, actually, so the way I heard about Bitcoin was from another show that I'm involved with, which is Free Talk Live. So Free Talk Live is a nationally syndicated radio show. They're on, you know, 160 radio stations or something like that. And they're also, the archives are posted as a podcast. So they've got this aspect of being a podcast, but also being a radio show. And back in 2011, the main hosts of that show, Ian and Mark, were approached by Gavin Andreessen. And at the time, he was living in Massachusetts, like pretty near where the show is, where Free Talk Live is based, in New Hampshire. And so Gavin said, guys, I've got this thing that I've been working on. He was probably still in touch with Satoshi at that point, or maybe had been recently out of touch with Satoshi. 2011. Yeah, I guess maybe Satoshi's last heard from in 2010. So maybe slightly after that. But basically he said, guys, I've been working on this thing. I want to tell you about it. It's called Bitcoin, and it's a revolutionary new kind of digital currency that could possibly change the world. So Ian and Mark heard him out, and I think he gave him some Bitcoins. At the time, Bitcoins were like, you know, I remember Gavin telling this story where he bought 50,000 Bitcoins or 10,000 Bitcoins for $50. And he was running this Bitcoin faucet website that would give you 5 Bitcoins if you just put in a Bitcoin address. So, I mean, could you imagine that now? Like if you could get 5 Bitcoins, just go into a website, put in an address. But yeah, he was doing that, and he was funding it out of his own pocket. And he was trying to promote Bitcoin and get the word out about it. So telling these nationally syndicated radio hosts about it seemed like a good idea. So so they heard him out about it, and they're not technical guys, but they saw the vision. They saw the potential for Bitcoin to really be a great thing for people getting more autonomy, I guess, over their use of currency, you know, putting the money back into the hands of the people and having a way to buy and, you know, trade things that didn't depend on these gatekeepers like the banks, you know, and the central banks, of course. So they were really excited about that. And they started talking about Bitcoin on the radio pretty much daily. And they encountered some skepticism at first, but a lot, I think, tons of people, probably thousands of people, maybe tens or hundreds of thousands of people found out about Bitcoin from Free Talk Live. And I was one of them because I was involved with their radio show. I was doing a Sunday show, hosting the show on Sunday nights because it goes 7 nights a week. And then on Sunday, they kind of bring in the farm team to to fill in and do the Sunday night show. So yeah, so I was involved with the show and I heard about Bitcoin that way. And I really found out and answered a lot of those beginner questions that people have when they're first finding out a bit about Bitcoin early on. I started doing research. I started reading the Bitcoin Talk forum. I downloaded the Bitcoin client and started using it. And at the time, I live in New Hampshire, where there's basically a community of freedom-loving people. The reason I moved here was because I was interested in something called the Free State Project, which is a bunch of libertarians, basically, or just freedom lovers, people who are interested in getting more freedom in their lives, moving to one place and trying to be free, whatever that means to them. And so there's a community of people here who also like freedom. And those people, I think, are naturally inclined towards Bitcoin. So all these liberty-loving people started using Bitcoin. And there were people buying, like, sandwiches, I remember, for, like, a 5 Bitcoin Casatius coin, like way back in like 2011, there were people, you know, trading silver for Bitcoin. Like there's just all kinds of interesting stuff going on because there was a community of people who found out about Bitcoin really early and were actually starting to use it.
It's interesting to me to hear you talk about, you know, definitely the freedom and sort of the political aspects of Bitcoin being what drew you in. Tony and I have talked before about, you know, what really pulled us. For me, it was technology. It was the actual, technical nature of Bitcoin, the problems that it solved in computer science, and the applications of not just Bitcoin, but all the stuff that can be built on top of it. I mean, Tony, what was it for you?
I mean, it was a few different things. The technology is, you know, one of the main things, and I think that's why I was not necessarily quicker to understand it, but quicker to, you know, get involved than many. But in the same token, you know, it solves a lot of problems. You know, little problems like how much it costs just to send money around and things like that you really don't think about until you're forced to. And then when you think about it, you go, wait, this really solves that issue, you know. And it's not, for me, it's more elegant, it's easier to use, and, you know, you really aren't depending on, you know, a person to control it. I always say I trust math more than I trust people.
Well, that's easy.
It's pretty easy. So I definitely think that's a part of it. And the more I learn about it, the more I got into it. And I think it's weird, though, because people do get involved for many different reasons. You know, a lot are political, a lot are technological, a lot of them are, you know, purely economical. Some of them are just think it's a neat idea and, you know, just want to play around with it. And there's a lot of real positive things that can come out of this. It's just a matter of really, you know, what does attract it to you and how can you further that to make it more, I guess, more widespread in the community that you're in. And that's how I got involved in the scene is, you know, helping out my local community when I was in Detroit. And from there, you know, it is, I would say Detroit's probably one of the slowest to grow areas to be involved with Bitcoin because it's very manufacturing centric. So that definitely is a hindrance there. But
there's some interesting stuff going on. Like we're in Detroit. So I've heard about the Detroit Bus Company, you know, this private bus that's basically taken over for the failed city's public transit and the Threat Management Center, which is basically like they're not police. They're like a group of people that goes and tries to resolve conflicts in a nonviolent way and like de-escalate situations before they get to be any kind of conflict. So there's a lot of interesting stuff that might appeal to Bitcoiners going on there.
I would agree. I also think, though, when it comes to the secure, that I don't want to necessarily call them security forces, but that's what I will call them. It's really just fulfilling the need of the police that aren't there in the city. And the same with the busing, because there is no real public transportation. I mean, Detroit has a busing system and a thing called the People Mover that's useless. There is no rail. There's nothing. And it's such an auto-centric town that they assume, I mean, by they, I mean, you know, the city planners would assume everyone has a car. You know, GM definitely made it. GM and Ford and Chrysler made it a point to get rid of streetcars in a lot of major cities in America throughout the 50s, and Detroit was one of the first. So if you don't, you know, there's so much money behind that lack of public transportation, and when you see things like that, it makes you wonder, you know, can an area that's so invested in that one industry ever fix the problems like transportation? And I think until that they, you know, put their eggs in more than one basket, that's just going to continue to be a problem. But, you know, I guess, you know, it's something where I guess I don't live there anymore. I'm in Atlanta now, so I still love Detroit. It's still my hometown, but they have a lot of issues. And I think there's some interesting things, but I don't know if it's right for Bitcoin yet. Now, Ann Arbor, which is 45 minutes away, definitely ready for Bitcoin.
I mean, I think that's kind of almost the wrong way to look at it, to say that a place isn't ready for Bitcoin. You know, nowhere is ever ready for new technology or new, you know,
right.
You know, really liberal or radical ideas. You know, you have to bring it to them. You know, the reason why, for example, I would say, okay, my mom's not ready for Bitcoin. You know, I tell her to go send a Bitcoin to, you know, one capital L, lowercase x, you know, capital M, and she's going to be like, what are you talking about? But then it's the responsibility of us and the other businesses in the ecosystem to find ways to bridge that gap and to abstract that difficulty away and to take care and actually solve the problems that you're alluding to by building onto the technology. I think if we're waiting for, you know, for Detroit to put up a sign that says, we want Bitcoin, we're going to be waiting quite a while.
I do think, though, that when it comes to certain areas or regions, some are more open to new technologies than other. I mean, obviously, you know, Silicon Valley.
Sure.
There's obvious ones there, but I think that others are also just a little more likely to, I don't know, just shy away from it. Not necessarily for any other reason other than cultural roots and what has built that local economy.
Sure, and I mean, I would agree that, you know, some areas are more predisposed to accepting Bitcoin and some are less, but, you know, I think that saying a place isn't ready for it is a little bit more of a hard line. So
Absolutely. And I think with that being said, Stephanie, since you've talked to many different people in the Bitcoin space, what do you think about, like, at least in America, different regions? Who's accepting it more? Who's not? I mean, and I don't know if you can necessarily have, like, the data in front of you. Just kind of anecdotally, what are you feeling about that?
Oh, my gosh, that's a really interesting question. I have actually traveled a lot over the past year and a half to many different Bitcoin conferences, a lot of them in the U.S., but some outside, too. You know, anecdotally, I mean, and of course I'm biased because I live here, but New Hampshire was like where it's at for the longest time. You know, they, I think, really embraced Bitcoin early and got a strong, like, network of Bitcoin people. And there was, like, the Llama Sioux Bitcoin ATM came out of New Hampshire, which you wouldn't really expect, right? You think of New Hampshire and you don't really think tech. You think, like, maple syrup, perhaps, or, like, leaf peepers. But there actually were, like, quite a few people working on Bitcoin businesses and people mining Bitcoins really early. Like, there are definitely some Bitcoin millionaires, I guess, that came out of New Hampshire who just got in really early. And Eric Voorhees lived here at one point too, when he was doing Satoshi Dice and Coinapult as well. The Porcupine Freedom Festival, which happens every summer in New Hampshire, it's like a Free State Project event, was just full of people using Bitcoin from the very, like, basically since about 2011. It was just everybody was using Bitcoin there to buy food, to trade stuff. There were, like, you know, Bitcoin ATMs at Porkfest in the middle of the woods where there's no internet. So I saw a lot of that. But also San Francisco, of course, you know, is like a big area for Bitcoin. Like, now it's grown. Like, the first Bitcoin conference, really, I guess there were ones that were early, but the first big Bitcoin conference from the Bitcoin Foundation was in San Jose back in 2013. And, you know, that area has a lot of Bitcoin startups, of course, and a lot of Bitcoin meetups. Austin, Texas is also a big one. Like, there's a lot of people who are really serious cryptography, people coding and making software there. So I would say, yeah, San Francisco, Austin, and New Hampshire, hotspots.
It seems like two of them also are hipster hotspots. I wonder if, you know, what's next? Portland?
Over Portland.
There might be some hipsters in New Hampshire too, maybe.
As far as, you know, emerging technologies go, is there anything else that really excites you or interests you? And it could be Bitcoin or blockchain related or something that maybe isn't at all.
Oh boy. Well, I'm really interested in biomedical technologies, you know, coming from this background of studying medicine and science. I'm interested in how we can hack the human body and make it so that we can live longer and live better quality of life. And I've been following the SENS Foundation and, like, the life extension kind of research for almost a decade now. And I'm actually working on an audiobook of the book Ending Aging by Aubrey de Grey right now, which is a pretty seminal book in the anti-aging, like, human life extension kind of movement, making it into an audiobook. So I'm really excited about biotechnology. Maybe even, like, integrating that with the blockchain somehow. Like, I've had a couple of ideas to, like, maybe decentralize scientific publishing somehow, you know, because it's really full of – it's an industry that's still full of gatekeepers, and the peer review process is just so riddled with problems, you know. I don't even want to go into it right now. But, like, if that could be decentralized, that would be really cool. And also perhaps some way of decentralizing medical records where, you know, you have your own – information where you can invite people in to access it instead of some government agency or some doctor's office, like, storing your health information. You could store your own health information on some kind of decentralized system, and you could control who can access your health data and what parts of it they could access.
That's actually fantastic. I think that something I've noticed, and I noticed Google is going a lot into, like, the artificial intelligence companies, and you know, I think life extension goes hand in hand with those. It really does, I think, change the game a little bit of who will control the future for medicine. You know, is it going to be your pharmaceutical companies? Is it going to be, you know, your hardware manufacturers, or will it be, you know, a little bit of both? You know, I think that's very fascinating, and good things are going to come out of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think it even changes the game more than that. You know, one of my favorite things to look at is there's an organization, I believe, called Humanity Plus, and it's like Ray Kurzweil and some of those kind of guys. who founded it, and it's sort of the idea that the synthesis of nanotechnology, of the advances we're making in medicine, of, you know, Moore's Law and the continuing improvement of computing and artificial intelligence, all coming together to eventually, and maybe this is a little too far out there, but to eventually make us sort of transcend humanity, you know. The idea of immortality, while I don't think it will be achieved in our lifetimes, is on the table, you know, in a world where you can sort of modify molecules at your own whims, you can basically, you know, turn sand into gold, which is also why you can have, you know, the classic gray goo example of everybody dying and the entire world turning into a horrible wasteland just to uplift us, you know. Yes.
What a cheerful moment of
that's what I'm here for, is for the positive vibes.
Absolutely. And from someone who studies the scene, Stephanie, what exactly would your opinion be of how fast is this moving? Is it keeping up with the standard technological pace of Moore's Law, or is this something where folks in the field need more funding? What exactly are the issues that it's facing right now? And I realize this is a broad subject, but I think that, you know, getting a little more in depth of what's needed may actually be more positive toward achieving one of these goals.
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I wish more people would ask that or reflect on that maybe. One of the main things that I see right now is, like, there's a lot of really exciting secondary kind of applications of Bitcoin. Like, you know, there's a lot of platforms that ride on top of Bitcoin and these Bitcoin 2.0 technologies that you can do these amazing things with, you know, issuing tokens and, you know, smart contracts and smart property and all that stuff. And that's great. And that's going to be important in the future. But most people don't know what Bitcoin is yet. They have no idea. They haven't even gotten to the kiddie pool yet of Bitcoin. So, like, we need to really work on, I think, spreading the word about just the basics first. It may take 5-10 years for it to catch on in a really mainstream way. I suspect less, because there's lots of people and lots of companies working hard to make sure that Bitcoin is accessible to everybody and that everybody can take advantage of it, especially in the developed world where there's easy access to internet. But yeah, I think maybe we need to, like, get the word out about the basics a little bit more before we start introducing these really advanced. Yeah. And some people disagree with that. They say that, you know, you can introduce the basics and the more advanced stuff at the same time, because it's all part of the same concept. And yeah, that may be true, but people have a lot of questions usually when they first find out about Bitcoin. And I've had actually the most success, I would say, like, explaining it to people on a one-on-one basis and just pulling out my phone mobile wallet and sending them some millibits and just showing them how it works. And they say, oh yeah, that makes sense, I get it. And then they come back with questions later. So maybe my feeling is that focusing on the basics and getting the essential message out in a really broad way is probably going to be very, very important in this next phase of growth.
Absolutely. I also think that when you were going into explaining it to people, this is more of a question. Have you encountered a lot of folks who are just completely outright hostile to the idea, and as soon as you say it, won't listen to another word?
I haven't really talked to anybody like that. Like, I've seen Peter Schiff, like, talk about Bitcoin.
Yeah.
I was actually speaking at a conference where he was also speaking, and I gave a talk about Bitcoin, and like, a lot of people at this conference, this was last year, a lot of people at this conference were hearing about Bitcoin for the first time, and A lot of people at this conference had a lot of questions about Bitcoin. They were really curious and interested. And then, like, a few hours after my talk, Peter Schiff came on and started talking about, oh, Bitcoin's a scam, it has no intrinsic value. And then everyone was kind of like, their enthusiasm kind of was like, meh, like, it kind of deflated. So I guess I haven't really, like, encountered anyone personally who was outright hostile to it. A lot of people were like, well, maybe I'll wait until the price goes down to buy some. You know, that's a common reaction. Oh, it's too expensive right now. I know in the past it's been $1, so I'll wait till it goes down. But they may be waiting a while. And now it's down. Hey, it's $400, right? Bitcoin price right now, $400 today. So if you've been waiting, if you said at 1,000 that you were going to wait till it goes down, then now's your chance, right?
Absolutely. I know I'm actually buying a couple this week. I will say that for sure. The other thing that we definitely wanted to touch on here is anything that you have coming up and making sure that you have anything you want to plug other than, you know, Let's Talk Bitcoin, which is highly recommended. What else are you up to in the coming months, and what else do you want to plug?
Oh, boy. Well, in a couple weeks here, I'll be taking off for the Coins in the Kingdom conference. That's going to be in Orlando, Florida at Disney World. That sounds like really fun. So maybe I'll see some people there. And then also taking off to Inside Bitcoins Vegas the same weekend. I'm going to be going from Orlando to Las Vegas the beginning of October. Then I guess, what else? I don't know. I mean, there's so much going on. I think what I'll just say is if you want to see what I'm up to in the voiceover world, you can check out my website, which is smvoice.info, and you can see all the voice projects that I'm working on.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much for doing the show, and we hope to have you back again. And thanks again.
Yeah, thanks, guys. This was really fun. Thanks for having me on your show.
Yeah, we totally appreciate it. Thank you.
Thanks.
You can follow Stephanie on Twitter at @S_Murphy_PhD. Check out her website at smvoice.info and listen to her podcast on letstalkbitcoin.com as well as on iTunes.
That's all for this week's episode. You can follow Eric on Twitter at Martindale, Gentry at Gentry Cheryl, and myself at Tony Swish. If you'd like to find out more about Decentralize, you can find us on the web at decentralizetheworld.net or follow us on Twitter at DecentralizeAll. I'm Tony Sokich.
I'm Eric Martindale.
And I'm Gentry Cheryl. Thanks for joining us.